nobody I know could love me more than you. You can give me so much love, it seems untrue.
Our next guest on Downtown is a musician, singer, producer, manager, radio host, and now he adds the title of author to his resume, a wonderful new book entitled The Beatles from A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour. We're very happy to welcome Peter Asher back to the program. Peter, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always good to talk to you.
Love the book so much. I love the organization of it, but as you explain, you thought it perhaps might be an easy transition to take some of these stories from the SiriusXM show and turn them into a book, but it sounds like apparently this writing is pretty hard work.
Well, exactly. I mean, you'd think that, you know, because this wasn't my idea, by the way. It was, you know, the radio show I was doing anyway, and I had the idea of doing those 26 episodes of it as The Beatles from A to Z, using the alphabet to supply not only, you know, song titles, but people and places and musical instruments and ideas and all kinds of stuff. Basically, an idea I stole from Sesame Street. So, but then a publisher came and said, we think that, you know, that A to Z would make a great book. And I was thinking, oh, that sounds pretty easy. You know, just transcribe whatever I said on the radio and it'll be a book. And of course, what happens is you do that, you transcribe it and you start reading it and you go, this is just awful as a book. You know, it doesn't work because, you know, the way you talk to people when you're talking to them on the radio isn't the same as what you want to read in the book. And of course, on the radio, you can go ahead and play the record. In the book, you have to explain why the record's so special and so good and what was remarkable about the Beatles. So anyway, it turned out to be much more of a task than I realized. But it was kind of fun and actually made me look at some of the tunes and some of the ideas and things that I'd always taken for granted and try and figure out how to, you know, add to people's, if I could, add to their appreciation and understanding of the Beatles and what they stood for and what they accomplished and their great songs.
Well, wonderful stories, and it expands beyond the sphere of just the Beatles to talk about other artists, adventures on the road, and a wonderful global perspective on music. And some of them, yeah, I did what you suggest in the book. I went immediately online and started listening to some music, some that I knew very well, some I thought I knew. And I just want to throw a few of them out there from the book. I was so happy to see that you enjoy as much as I do, Eddie Izzard's interpretation of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Yes, it's excellent. It's bizarre and it's wonderful, and I'm a big Eddie Izzard fan. He's totally brilliant.
I also love the story that you tell about Russ Kunkel. Can you explain how Russ Kunkel was inspired by Ringo's drum fills on With a Little Help from My Friends when you were in the process of recording James Taylor, especially Fire and Rain?
Yes. Well, when I came out to L.A. to make James's first American album, you know, I was looking to put a little band together, and I found Russ Kunkel. He'd never done a session before as a studio musician, but he was actually playing with a guy called John Stewart, a wonderful songwriter, not the John Stewart on television, but a terrific guy, and I heard his drumming and loved it, because he was doing, in the general sense, a bit what Ringo does, which is just play exactly what the song needs and no more, you know. So whereas some drummers frantically try to fill it, get in a lot of flashy stuff, you know, which has its place and is great to hear and see, but Ringo kind of arranges a drum part for the song, and Russ does that too. And when it came to Fire and Rain, there's no question but the fills, you know, those big boom 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 sort of fills that Russ played with brushes, which is interesting too, when we recorded that song, they certainly owe something to the fills in Day in the Life and some other Beatles songs where they've got those beautiful, big, fat, solid Ringo fills that are just designed precisely for the space they fill.
Well, and another one of those is one of my very favorite Beatles songs of all time, and that's Rain. What is it about that song that you love so much?
Well, it's interesting because it's very different. I mean, in terms of the drum part specifically, since we were talking about Ringo, you know, I was talking to Ringo. I told him I was writing about drum fills, and he asked me what some of my favorites were. And when I mentioned Rain, he explained that he's playing very differently on that than anything else he's ever played. He just started playing the drums kind of in a different order, and they in a way, they're a little un-Ringo-ish, but they're brilliant. I mean, they're quite extraordinary, the drumming on Rain. And there's those places where he and Paul McCartney worked out those fills precisely together. You know, there's that place where the bass plays a melodic line as the drums play the fill. You probably know the place. I mean, I'm not going to sing it, but it's one of those pauses where everything stops for a minute, and the drums and the bass have a little sort of moment of their own, and then bring everybody back in. And I love that record anyway. There's so much about it that's unusual and original. And that can be said of so many Beatles songs. You know, that's what's so interesting. I talk about time signatures and how you know, often they used, without even particularly thinking about it, they would have bars of 5/4 and 7/4 and stuff mixed in with regular rock and roll beats in a way that was quite unusual. And they still made it rock. I mean, it still sounded like rock and roll. So it's among their many achievements.
I love the story you shared, because if you had access to the Beatles, then not everybody had. And so you heard the song Help before it was ever released as a single. And you got to share that a little bit when you were out on the Dick Clark Caravan.
I did, yes. It's not something I'm immensely proud of, but I had learned a little bit of the song because Paul had played it to me a few times. I mean, it's a John song, but obviously, you know, in the course of recording it, obviously Paul learned it completely. And I'd learned a bit of it. And I do confess that just it was somewhere between sort of showing off and name dropping that when we were out on tour on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars with, you know, Brian Hyland and the Shirelles and the Drifters and all kinds of people, I did say, you know, oh, listen to this, isn't this cool? This is going to be the Beatles' next single. And would show off by playing a little bit of it. And I'm not sure whether they believed me or not. I like to think that when Help came out a little while later, they kind of went, oh, he wasn't making it up after all. Because I'd only learned a piece of it, you know, but enough to kind of just the opening part in the verse, which I think was so great. And of course now you that would be dangerous. You couldn't do that because somebody would have filmed it on their phone.
Right,
you'd be in all kinds of trouble.
We're talking with Peter Asher. His new book is The Beatles from A to Z, and Under the Letter F, one of my very favorite Beatles songs with a beautiful French horn that's part of it. Can you talk a little bit about For No One?
Yeah, I mean, the French horn solo is just brilliant and very original. I mean, you don't hear many French horns on pop records. They hear them a lot in classical music and movie scores and stuff. You know, and they have this beautiful, subtle tone. They were originally derived from a hunting horn. You know, it was just the thing you'd play to, you know, to get the pack together. But I think it was Paul's idea to use the French horn. And Paul had learned a lot about classical music very quickly, you know. He probably learned about all the other brass instruments, but from dance bands and stuff like the one his father had. But French horn's primarily a classical instrument, so he might have become aware of that through my mother, and who was a professional classical musician. I don't know. But he suggested the French horn, and George Martin took that and ran with it, you know, and between them they composed that beautiful solo. And George Martin got the best French horn player in the land to play the horn. And I remember at the time in London, the studio gossip was all about, you know, at that time, regular scale for doing a session in the studio, a three-hour session, was £9. And the horn player on For No One asked for and got a recital fee of £50, and everyone went, oh my God, what nerve and how amazing, you know, which he totally deserved. And of course, in retrospect, £50 for that solo is the bargain of the century.
Speaking of George Martin, a wonderful connection that I learned about in the book between George Martin and your mother.
Yeah, isn't that odd? It's one of the strange things that, you know, you couldn't make up, which is, it is true that, you know, George Martin had studied the oboe at the Guildhall School of Music, where he learned it. And my mother was actually a professor at the Royal Academy of Music, a different college. But he had wanted to take some private lessons, and someone obviously had recommended my mother as one of the good oboe teachers, which she certainly was. And so he had taken quite a number of private lessons from my mother long before they met later on in a Beatle context, you know. It's an extraordinary coincidence. So the first member of our family to meet, you know, to have any Beatle connection whatsoever was her and George Martin. Though, of course, at the time, George Martin wasn't yet working with the Beatles.
You also played a role somewhat in John and Yoko coming together after you started the bookshop. That's a wonderful story.
That's right. Yeah, we started a bookshop, and then after that got going, we started the art gallery. And my friend John Dunbar, who was running the art gallery, had heard about Yoko Ono and invited her to come do an exhibition in London at our gallery. And, she accepted, and they set a date, and we took ads and made the deal and all that stuff. And what you do often is before you have the actual opening at which you invite the press and everything, once it's all set up in the gallery, you do a kind of pre-opening evening and invite friends over to have a look at the exhibition. And that's what we did, and we invited all our various friends over, which at that point in time included the Beatles. So I think we invited all of them, but it was John who came, and that's when he met Yoko for the first time.
One of the big surprises in the book for me was to learn that one of the most iconic Beatles songs could have been a hit first for Tom Jones.
Yeah, now which one was that? I remember discovering that and being fascinated by it myself and putting it in the book. Which song was it?
Long and Winding Road.
Long and Winding Road, that's right. I knew it was some really important song. Apparently, and this has been backed up by a couple of people, there was, Paul was thinking about how well Tom Jones would sing it, which he undoubtedly would or would have. And at one point it suggested that maybe Tom could record it before it came out on a Beatles album and he might be the person to have the hit with it. But somehow it didn't happen. Tom Jones had already just finished an album or something and they weren't ready to put anything else out for a while. Or for some record company technical reasons, it never happened. But actually, Tom Jones could have done a great version of that song without doubt. Paul often did that. I mean, he'd write a song and think, oh, this would be great for so-and-so, whether or not they actually did it. But I think he perhaps was helped by imagining some of his favorite singers, imagining Ray Charles or Peggy Lee or whoever it was, sing whatever song he was working on would give him a new perspective on it.
You got to go on the Ed Sullivan Show, and we played Nobody I Know that you performed on the Sullivan Show, but you explained in the book that Bobby Rydell kept you from performing your first big hit, A World Without Love.
It's true, he did. It's true. Not intentionally, of course. But what had happened was somebody had sent Bobby's manager a copy of World Without Love as soon as it came out in England, which was about a month before it came out in America. And the manager suggested it to Bobby as a song he might want to cover, which he did. And he made a record of it and came out the same time as ours. And, of course, Bobby Rydell was already a big star. So we were quite flattered that he'd done it, but also worried, of course, that it would prevent us getting a hit. And in the long run, we did get the hit. Our record took off. We both were in the charts with Bullets at one point, but ours took off and went to number one. And it seemed to have had no ill effect at all until first time we got to New York after World Without Love was number one. Our agent, was trying to get us on the Ed Sullivan Show, which normally would have been no problem because they liked the new English bands with number one records. But the Sullivan people apparently said, oh, no, we can't have them on because Bobby Wright did that song on the Sullivan Show 2 weeks ago. We can't do the same song again. So, but it didn't seem to matter. So, and I know Bobby since then, of course, and there was no malice involved at all. But, and his version was kind of cool, but different. But, in the end, we had the hit, so all is well.
You've met so many people in the music business through the years, but your meeting with Janis Joplin was perhaps less than memorable.
Well, it was memorable in an odd way, yes, because I had made it to Woodstock. We'd somehow managed to get onto one of the helicopters, which was the only way to get to the actual gig. And we'd not only that, but we'd succeeded in getting a hotel room for the night because you couldn't move. The traffic was seized up and the people had abandoned their cars and all that stuff. And I finally got a key to a hotel room somehow. I don't remember how. And we were making our way down the corridor, which was kind of crowded, to the hotel room. And I stepped over a woman sleeping across the corridor and with a bottle of Jack Daniels in her hand. And looked down and went, oh, it's Janis Joplin, look at that. And then we went in our room and went to bed. So it's not exactly a meeting, but nonetheless, it was sort of memorable.
Peter, you mentioned in the book that the Beatles had four great singers. And I think that's a great point that you make because people who weren't around at the time don't understand some ways that those Ringo songs on albums were a real highlight for so many people.
Yes. I mean, the thing about the Beatles is that there was just a perfect storm, you know, that those four people with those four varied kind of talents and personalities came together at the right time and just created some of the best music ever. And yes, Ringo was immensely popular, and I think Ringo was the first solo Beatle to have a huge hit as well. I mean, Ringo's had a string of hits, you know, it's extraordinary. And you go back and listen to some of those great Ringo records, they're just terrific. And his new album, which is just out, which he produced himself, is really good.
Absolutely. He's coming here to Bangor. We're looking forward to him bringing the All-Star Band here.
That was always great. I love that tour, you know, with his All-Star Band. It's just killer.
Well, the book is absolutely delightful. I read it in one sitting because it's like being there listening to stories from an incredibly knowledgeable and talented Beatles fan and insider in many ways. But the appreciation that you have of their music and of what it spawned in rock and roll is just a delight to read. The book is great. And, Peter, it's wonderful for us to have the chance to talk with you again.
Thank you very much. Those were great questions. And you obviously really read the book, and I appreciate that. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Our pleasure here. Peter Asher on Downtown. The book is called The Beatles from A to Z.